Happy Thursday?
Happy birthday? What?
Yeah.
Today's Drew Bragg's birthday.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Happy birthday, Drew. And you got to get on our podcast. Saturday. At some point, Drew, you
Dude,
have
for
to...
real.
Drew's excuse to not come on is always that he doesn't have anything interesting to talk about. But now he's on the program committee for RailsConf. We know for sure that he has something interesting to talk about, at least after that. So,
well, dude, we can trick him easily because I often will just ping him randomly and then tell him a bunch of random ADHD facts I've learned that day and then be like, oh, by the way, do you want a pair? And he'll just click any Zoom link I give him. So
that's like, what we need to do. It'll
once
just,
he's here, it's
he'll
too
sign
late.
In and it'll be like, this meeting is being recorded and I'll just happen to be here.
Yeah. Just turn your camera on. I mean, we'll change your name in Slack to Andrew's like meeting bot or something.
Yeah.
As soon as I hit record, you turn your camera on and get it rolling, baby.
Love it.
Catfishing. Oh, my birthday's on Saturday.
Dude. Happy early birthday.
I don't want it. Thank you, though.
The end of the year and my birthday. My birthday is in the end of May, so it ends up being like almost every 6 months. Good time of year to just check and make sure, are you happy with what you're doing with your life? Are you enjoying it? Do you want to change things? Every new year is a good one, obviously, to like ask yourself that. But birthday also, the weird one is when you're like filling out those registration forms. What age bracket are you in? And you're like,
I'm
no longer in the 24 to 34 or whatever it is. I just moved up. This is bad.
Yeah, I don't want to think about it. I'd rather think about code instead.
Yeah.
What's going on this week?
Yesterday, this is going to be a fun rant. So I think it was Friday. Somebody, Hatchbox customer, was like, yeah, tried to update my server and the Postgres configuration file is missing. That's new. I've not seen that before. You know, and you install Postgres 17 on Ubuntu, it installs and creates a cluster and the config files and all that. Well, his server didn't. And I like uninstalled the package and reinstalled it and asked him if he did anything weird and nothing, but it didn't create anything. And I was like, this is strange. So spent a little while on that, didn't figure it out before the end of the day and plan to come back to it this week. Well, we had another customer that ran into it yesterday. This isn't just a one-off problem. It seemed like it. Now it is definitely something repeatable. And I can guarantee you neither one of these customers did anything weird. They have access to their servers, unlike Heroku or Render or something. So like there are times where people are like, yeah, I installed Apache or Nginx or something. And it's like, well, you can't do that because Caddy needs to be there or whatever. So Colin and I hop on Tuple. I just need you here to be my moral support as I figure this out. Because I knew it was going to end up in the weeds real far. So the only thing I could figure out was, let's assume that the Debian package has changed probably. They're just like Ruby gems where you download it. If there's a C extension, it runs the code to go compile the C extension. Debian packages are the same concept where it's, here's a bunch of files. We're going to unzip them somewhere. And then we got some pre-install and post-install and pre-remove and post-remove scripts that run. For as long as I can remember, Postgres always creates a cluster by default when you install a different version. And I was like, I think we need to go and extract the Debian package and see if it has that config file in there. It does not. So then we start like, well, maybe the post-install or pre-install scripts that are bash scripts. Sure enough, I start reading through the post-install. Well, it's now checking. There's a function in here that goes and checks to see if there are any other Postgres config files in etc PostgresQL. And it's, well, yeah. And then it just returns if there is one and skips the rest of the functions. But that's weird. This must be new because the old versions don't do that. We spun up a new VM and installed Postgres 17. It created the cluster by default, like normal. But if you uninstall it, then install 16 and then add 17 to it, 16 creates a cluster, 17 does not. So apparently this is a change that's not documented anywhere. It probably doesn't affect most people, but we are modifying that config file so that you can use Postgres properly on your private network and stuff and Patchbox and whatever. So we have expectations that that file is going to exist. But after all these years of working on Hatchbox, like 8 years or more, all of a sudden, you know, one day last week that decided to change. And Postgres 17's package has been out for a little while. So I don't know if this is a new change to that or what. I know that people have upgraded their servers almost certainly from 16 to 17, and we haven't run into that until last week. So that was the weirdest story, because in college, in high school as well, when I really got into programming, it was because I had a laptop with Linux on it and dial-up at home, and I could not download software because, like, you have to apt install downloading all these dependencies for Linux. Whereas, like, on Windows, you download the installer for some game, and it's got all the dependencies built into it. So I could slap that stuff on a flash drive easily and take it home, but not with Linux. So I ended up teaching myself Python and object-oriented programming, and I reverse engineered the package manager apt on Ubuntu so I could recreate it in Python and run it at school on my flash drive and download all the packages and then install them offline. That led me to doing Google Summer of Code 1 year while I was in college, because I kept working on this project, and we built a package manager for Windows way back when. And I got really familiar with the package structure of the repositories and all that stuff. But that was a long time ago, 2007, 2008, whatever. Super long time ago.
Freshman year of high school.
Yeah, I was like a senior in high school when I started or something, and then continued working on it while I was in college a bit. Then we had dorm room internet, which was plenty fast, but it was like wild to have that experience where I was, yeah, it's not going to be that useful later on in life. And then yesterday I was like, I know exactly what to do to figure out the real answer here. Somewhere on the internet, there is a repository of that post-install script and the Debian packaging steps. I have no idea where to find it. You can search for that and you don't find those comments and whatever else, whatever other code is in that file. So it's hard to find that, but whatever, we can jump straight to the source. But it was crazy to be like, yeah, my experience from 20 years ago
finally paid off.
My God. Yeah.
When you get Postgres 17, I assume when you just run apt whatever Postgres, is that how it's getting there?
Yep. Apt install. So Ubuntu will choose versions that they're going to support for 5 years. And they will not do any major version updates for that. You will only get bug and security fixes. So whenever Ubuntu 24.04 drops, they may not even use the latest Postgres because they might want to prefer the one before the latest one for stability. So we don't use that repository. We use the official Postgres repository.
Okay.
So that one, we can always get the latest Postgres from it and stuff, which in theory is the ideally the repository you're running to use, because it's made by the Postgres maintainers. But I learned my lesson that the certbot let's encrypt package, which is also their official instructions, early days of Hatchbox, use apt install certbot. They actually turned out not to have somebody who was on the team that really knew how to package Debian packages, and turned out to be super old. Serious bugs built into it and stuff that they continue telling people to use that for the longest time. And then you find later on in their issues, yeah, we don't have anyone doing this anymore. It's really outdated and old and broken. And well, why didn't you update the website with the instructions? What do you mean? So yeah, there's some nuance to it all, because the Ubuntu maintainers are like more, at least for LTS release, which is what you want in production, their aim is for stability and security. I don't give a shit about the latest features, which is fair.
Fair. So, yeah, no, that's fair. Because my first question was, why don't you just use Nix? And then I don't understand. Just install 16 and get it over with. That answers that. Yeah. That's fun.
It was reminiscent when I called Colin. I was like, this is going to feel like our, I forget what it was, 6 months into him working for GoRails. We had the GoRails server was like an old DigitalOcean server. It wasn't that old, but it was old enough that apparently at one point you had to go and select the kernel on your server's configuration in DigitalOcean's website. And it wouldn't just auto upgrade the kernel like it does now. So we updated Ruby one day and OpenSSL was blowing up. What is happening? And I stumble upon Mike Perham in an issue with Sidekick that's the same seg fault that we were experiencing. And Mike was just, sounds like something's totally screwed up on your server. And we're like, uh-oh, there's no way of going forward from here. This is bad. And we ended up writing, I don't know if Colin's ever written C before, but I wrote, we got into the Ruby source code, looked at where it references OpenSSL. We wrote our own little C program to also load up OpenSSL and do something. And it also segfaulted our tiny little C thing. And it was weird because it was calling some system function in the kernel that should be there or whatever. And it blew up. And that eventually tracked it down to, you need to go in DigitalOcean because your server is so old. Change the setting, which does not exist on new servers because it's automatically handled now. Dang, we're like feature flagged on some legacy stuff in DigitalOcean for our server, which we're not anymore now that we have just spun up another server and stuff eventually. But we fixed that because it was like, change this config. But in the depths of the DigitalOcean support forum, we eventually found that. Yeah, well, bet you didn't think you'd be writing C and dealing with kernels and seg faults and stuff when you signed up to do Ruby on Rails tutorials.
Not the kernel, dude. Speaking of OpenSSL, over the last two Ruby patch version updates, so 3.4.2, I tried to upgrade 3.4.2 and I got an error from the installation that was like, you're missing GMK dirt. That's weird. So I took a second and I was like, oh, I just need to brew install core utils and we're good to go. And then the version installed and like, that was weird. Now the next version comes out 3.4.3, I think. And I run into a brand new issue where we can't find OpenSSL. What do you mean you can't find OpenSSL? What has changed? And I think the OpenSSL thing ended up being me accidentally tweaking something in my ZSHenv, but that Ruby config option in my ZSHenv was wrong. It wasn't pointing to OpenSSL anyway. I don't understand how this has worked, but Mize was like, dude, that's not real. That's not there. And I was like, no, you're absolutely correct. That's not there. So I was able to like just change the Ruby config environment variable, and Mize has one too if I needed to overwrite it. That's so interesting that I haven't had a problem installing Ruby, and then all of a sudden the past two patch versions had to reinstall. I feel like I had core utils. I don't know where it went, but
yeah,
I thought that was just installed by default, but apparently not.
I don't remember running brew install core utils or anything like that for ever. Maybe it's one of the dependencies of another thing I typically install or something.
That's true. So it could have been.
That's fascinating.
I'm known for like keeping my brew situation is testy. Like I greedy update it and I update and upgrade it constantly. So you I'm too. Always doing that.
Almost every day I'll run the same brew update and upgrade and stuff. And
do you got to pass it greedy? And then that will make sure you're not
greedy.
Look at the docs on greedy, or like there's another greedy auto greedy or something, but they do slightly different things. It'll help you get a newer version of the package if you need it.
Gotcha. This is fascinating because I remember as you get into programming, this is something you will see two very separate groups of people where there will be the conservative folks who are like, the last thing you're going to get me to do is install the latest packages. I refuse to do that because I need stability and stuff. And then there are the other group of people who are always on the bleeding edge. I've been in the middle somewhere for a long time, but now I'm very much on the bleeding edge. For one, it's kind of my job. I need to be on that, running the latest Rails or whatever, so we can catch bugs and contribute back or whatever, and just make life easier for everybody else if we can, which is great. But then it comes to building Hatchbox. Actually, I want the stability for that, but I also need to be on the bleeding edge. And you mentioned Mize. So the other thing that we're in the middle of right now is we use ASDF for Hatchbox. So it's easy to install, you know, whatever language is. We happen to focus on Ruby and Rails. Lots of people want to install PHP and run WordPress next to their Rails app or something, whatever it is. Or you need, like, maybe somebody's building a custom Anycable Go or whatever thing. They might have other languages they want to use.
Might run a Rust extension.
Yeah. So 0.16 of ASDF, I guess.
I heard something about that. I've seen rumblings about it and I haven't looked into it, but I've heard that they made a bunch of changes.
Yeah, a bunch of changes, as in it used to be written in Bash and now it's written in Rust. And there are bugs out the wazoo because little things and decisions have to be remade because you're not using Bash. You're not using the same language anymore. So the fundamentals of those things tend to change a lot. And I was like, oh God. And I've been frustrated with a lot of the ASDF stuff in general anyways. It's kind of slow because it's all in Bash. But there are decisions about it. We're not going to do any environment variable stuff at all. And what I loved about RBM was the RBM vars plugin, where we could have environment variables for the current directory or whatever. Which
Mize does support.
Mize does. So we are probably going to migrate over to Mize. We're on a fork already of ASDF. So, like, we're pretty good. Minus also yesterday or the day before, the plugins are now slowly changing to be compatible with 16. So the Node.js one has a command to update node build, and the command changed now because their stuff changed in version 0.16 of ASDF. One of those things where my biggest frustration with building Hatchbox is that if we rely on literally anyone else's code, we get screwed over, guaranteed at some point. Things just break. We've pared everything down as much as possible, but we have to pick the supremely trustworthy tools, which are like Caddy. Caddy's phenomenal. Those guys are really good too about fixing bugs when something comes up. They're really, really strong maintainers and stuff. I trust that. That one's going to be great. ASDF was pretty good. But
it was amazing, you know, while it was at the top.
Yeah, when it came out, it was like, wait a minute, I don't have to have five tools. This is great.
It solves so many problems with me, especially with the versioning thing with you need MySQL 5. I was always running into that. It solved a lot of database versioning issues for me.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah, I forget who tweeted this, but the guy that's working on JDK, the Mize developer, JDEX.
Yes.
That's it. Did he work on Homebrew or something?
I'm not sure. I was going to say that Mize is written in Rust, so it's kind of interesting that you said that ASDF was rewriting in Rust, considering Mize uses a lot of ASDF plugins behind the scenes.
Yeah, which is fascinating. Yeah, I think he did. So I forget who, somebody from like Heroku or someone posted on social media that JDX, I don't actually remember his real name, that he had worked on Homebrew, which is why Mize was so strong. The configuration and flexibility of it and just the commands and all that, just super fast, super strong. And it's in effect very similar to Homebrew, where like that's a package manager. You're managing languages and versions with Mize, which is very similar to managing anything else that you might install, like Postgres versions with Homebrew. So I was like, ooh, that's a really good point. We're going to need to move to Mize at some point, which will be nice because I think we'll be able to pretty simply do that during the deployment process. So we can just detect, is ASDF in the path? Does that exist? Then yes, well, let's go upgrade and install Mize during your deployment. So it should be pretty seamless when we roll that out to customers. But dude, their environment variable stuff.
Dude, the task stuff too. Weed. It's so nice. Like you can get VM automatically with Python. You can also use template stuff into these tasks. You run a command and it will automatically, you could run it to set up a Python project where you like inject things. What else? You can watch files with it and run things on chain. They have hooks for entering directories.
Yep.
So much stuff.
The thing that really impressed me was like, okay, it manages environment variables. ASDF just told you like, go use dirtenv. Go use another tool. Okay, fine, but kind of annoying. Mize can not only set environment variables and load them and everything, but you can also tell it to go read a separate file, which happens to be pretty convenient because that's what we were doing with ASDF and RBMV. But then you can tell it an array of paths as well. So you can have it just add things to the path or whatever, which is wild. And then you have the ability to set a source. So you can have it run a separate program that exports environment variables for you that Mize then just runs whenever you execute one of the executables. That's amazing. And I had a long time ago made a proposal to ASDF about why don't we just have an ASDF vars command that just runs, loads the environment variables, just like RBM vars. It could just be built in and it's nothing to maintain. Super simple. They didn't want to do it, just wanted to make plugins only for languages, which is fine. That's their choice to do it. But then when I see Mize and it's like, he's thought of like four or five different ways of injecting environment variables in here. This is awesome. He's just thinking about all the like potential use cases and whatever. And it's great to come across projects like that, that are super thoughtful because it feels rare. Honey Badger is a performance monitoring and error tracking tool that combines the best monitoring features in one simple interface with support for all the frameworks you use. It's everything you need to gain real-time insights into the health of your applications. Be sure to bookmark honeybadger.io. That's www.honeybadger.io.
One thing with that I wanted to add on, going back to something we talked about a second ago, was you can actually use one password here if you think about it. Because Mize has these hooks and these tasks, sure. You could set up Mize to basically tap into one password and export the environment variables. Because one password with their OP CLI, like they are doing a bunch of stuff over there. So
like the Kamal integration.
Yes.
For secrets for one exactly. Password. Yeah. That's freaking sweet.
Yeah.
One password.
So I stalked him on LinkedIn. His name is Jeff. So we can keep calling him JDX, I guess. But he worked at Figma, Amazon, Meta, Dropbox, Heroku. I bet you're thinking of the Heroku.
Yeah. Heroku CLI.
Yeah.
Author of the Heroku CLI. Yes.
And which is very nice.
When I searched him, Homebrew Tap shows up too.
Oh, really?
So I don't know if he originally authored that or what, but maybe not. No, this is, I don't know, usage.rb thing. Anyways, yeah, it was the Heroku CLI thing that I saw. If we do have to use a separate tool and not build our own thing, you need to find projects like this. And
yeah,
those are so rare. But when you start reading their docs, and you see how thorough something like Tailwind or Mize or Caddy or whatever it is, they just are cut above the rest. Wow, these are rare, pretty darn rare. And I don't mind using those tools when it comes to building something that has to have dependencies. You don't want to reinvent the wheel on all this. You could, but you gotta do one for every single language. Good luck, have fun.
One thing that I saw recently with Mize, you can use different plugin managers, which we know, but what I found out the other day is you can even use NPM. So you can literally Mize add Prettier, get the executable for Prettier and use it without globally installing through a version of Node.
Whoa.
I don't think it works for Rails gems, but...
There's a gem backend. If you click on the backends and the...
Then that must have been recently added because I didn't
see it. Mize can be used to install CLIs from Ruby gems. The code for this is inside of the Mize repository, gem.rs. So yeah, Mize use -g gem colon RuboCop installs the following, the latest version of RuboCop and sets it as the active version on the path. Whoa.
I have like a .dot default gems file that Mize automatically uses whenever I install a new version of Ruby that automatically install certain things I need. I always use Overmind, no matter what. That would be like the perfect thing. It's like, yeah, okay, well, I don't need to do this. I'll just use it straight from Mize.
Yeah, that is awesome. This reminded me when I returned my Mac Studio that I was testing out, because the M4 Mac Studio, fingers crossed, drops this year with an M4 Ultra. But you know the appraisal gem where you can test your gem against seven different versions of Rails? Well, what I'm going to do is do something maybe on top of appraisal where you can set the Ruby versions you want to run. Because in my CI, I end up doing the matrix of here's all the gem files that appraisal generated, but also test against Ruby 2.7, 3.0, 3.1, 3.2, 3.4. Stupid big matrix at the end of the day if you do all those, which we've cut out some of the older ones now that they're end of life for Ruby. But you know how sick that would be is we could have Mize, because there's a command in Mize and it's execute this command with this specific version of the language. We could then have Mize in parallel go run Ruby 3.2, 3.4, 3.3, 3.1, 2.7, and run the appraisal tests for everything like in ultra parallel. And that would be wild to be able to effectively like do what I'm doing in GitHub Actions, but also locally, because there's so many situations where I end up with this. Actually, I've done this a few times where standard is set without a Ruby version thing. And so standardize for 3.4 ends up applying stuff that's not backwards compatible. And I only end up catching that in CI. And I'm like, it'd be cool to just catch all that locally.
You can set a Ruby version with standard, by the way.
Yeah, I've started doing that now. Yeah. It was just an example of one of those times I caught something only in CI because of a weird thing that I'm always testing with the latest Ruby. But
that's an interesting thing to run into. I never thought about that.
Yeah. Maybe if you're a gem author, it is more something you'll hit more often than an application developer. But that along with, I also want to build, so this will be like the super appraisal where you can specify the different gems, you can specify the different Ruby versions, and then other custom environment variables, which I think I can do with Mize, because my CI will spin up Redis and Postgres and MySQL and SQLite and run tests against different backends or whatever, including all of those Rails versions and stuff. And maybe that's a little overkill and I don't need to do all those permutations, but if we could just swap out the database URL environment variable while we're running our test suite locally, then I could run it against SQLite and Postgres and MySQL locally and just save myself the slow, like, change this thing, push it up to GitHub, wait 5 minutes, get an error, change another thing, push it up, wait again. I could just do it locally. And then my dream is just greens and GitHub CI.
There you go. You could probably set up Mize so that you could run a command and it would automatically set up 2.7 or whatever. And then it would automatically go set all the environment variables you need automatically. And you could just have a single like input options that triggers everything.
Yeah. And with those different things that they've got with the environment variables, you totally could. Dude, they have even lazy eval of environment variables. They've thought of so much stuff.
Yeah, I've been
sometimes you want to access environment variables produced by tools. That's freaking cool. I don't even know what I would use that for. You can redact environment variables with it too.
That's what I saw, which is super nice. That's why I brought up 1Password, because I think I saw a way to do encryption with that.
Yeah, that makes sense. I love tools like that.
I saw this, it was a while ago, because Mize changed names at some point, but...
Yeah, what was it before? I remember seeing it.
I don't remember.
Somewhere. It's like in the RBM wiki or something, as like alternative tools or somewhere.
About
Ruby build or something.
Mize was initially created by Jeff Dickey. There's his full name. I know what you're talking about, though. Not really.
Yeah,
important.
It's on the tip of my tongue, but
the reason
RTX.
Yeah. That sounds right. The reason why I was like, okay, I'm going to use Mize and I'm no longer worried about it is because I found, and this was before I started using Mize, so it's been a few months, I found that GitLab was switching over to Mize for everything. If GitLab is switching over to Mize for everything, they had migration instructions too, like in some of their internal documentation. Okay, yeah. I'm very comfortable using it if GitLab's using it. And then that was before DHS, like Basecamp is using it, and now a bunch of other companies, like we're all using it now. So there's a lot of people out there using it.
Yeah, Omakub, I think, was the first one that was Mize as the default or something. Originally, it was like RBM or something. And then, well, if we're building a customizable Ubuntu configuration or whatever, it makes sense to support other languages and stuff. And Rust has Rust up, and every language is starting to have their own custom thing. And it's like, I just want to run the version. I will focus on one language and that will be fine. But when I need to use another language, I don't want to have to learn their thing that's going to change. And I just don't keep up with it enough to mess with it. And so it's really awesome to have a tool that simplifies at least some of it. I don't know that it's necessarily much different than just running Ruby build directly or whatever like RBM does, but I've felt like it's been way more consistent and faster to like compile stuff or whatever. So I don't know if there's a little special sauce on top internally that they detect your operating system, maybe set an environment variable or whatever for you that isn't necessarily in the build steps normally or whatever. I'm not sure.
While we're on that subject, if you are switching to Mize and you try to install a version that isn't available, I tried to install like a version of Ruby and it was like, well, we can't find that version. If you run Mize cache clear, I'm sure there's other ways to do it as well, but like if you run Mize cache clear, then you can install it. I think it updates the, clears the cache.
That's one of the, that's one of the things that I do with, well, I think with Hatchbox, what we do is, so there's ASDF, and then you have to install the plugin for Ruby. It just doesn't come with ASDF, which is annoying. Mize also skips that step. The default available languages are all there. And the one thing that we ran into constantly that was annoying was, okay, the ASDF repository doesn't need to be updated that often, but then the ASDF Ruby plugin needs to be updated every time there's a new version of Ruby build. So you end up three dependencies deep. Ruby 3.4.2 came out, so then Ruby build gets updated. Then we got to wait for somebody to merge that into ASDF Ruby, and then eventually we can finally run it. They did add the ability for us to like say use Ruby build from main or master or whatever, so that we could tell it the branch and just skip and not have to wait for somebody who maintains ASDF to also update that. That was nice. You got to know that little trick, like clearing the cache or whatever environment variable you need just to skip to it. And I was like, well, a new version of Ruby came out. Somebody instantly got that in Ruby build because that's well maintained. But then like there's a middle layer that is a little bit slower maintenance. Well, I need to go test this so that other people can see if it's good to go. Because if we need to update Jumpstart or something, I need to test it as soon as possible because somebody else is chomping at the bit to go update too. So I can't wait that long.
Yeah. I guess he's updated the docs because this didn't used to be here, but right here on the Ruby language docs for Mize, manually updating rebuild. Ruby build should update daily. However, if you find the version does not exist yet, you can force an update. Mize cache clean, Mize LS remote Ruby. Boom.
That's awesome.
So I'm a big fan. The That's only cool. concern I slightly have is like he's adding in all these really great features, and I'm only worried about at some point it getting a little too bloated. But
or too complex to maintain all that. Yeah.
When I say bloated, that's kind of what I mean. We're like, you add all these amazing features, but we know the cost of adding features. And we also know how complex all this stuff is. I'm sure it's infinitely more complex than we can even imagine. So that was my only fear, is like, okay, he's adding in these amazing features, but I hope that it doesn't detract from the overall stability.
What I noticed was, there's also a new team page in the docs, and the team is still just Jeff. But he has three people on this advisory board who help make those important decisions on what features and whatever's coming up. And I thought that was interesting. And then the other thing that gives me confidence in it is there's a few open tickets from a decent time ago. But when you look at those tickets that are open or the issues on GitHub that are open, it's him. It's Jeff for all of them. He's clearing out and fixing everything else that comes up and anybody's questions. He's using this as his own tracker for issues or whatever other stuff that he has ideas on and stuff. Like 20 open issues, that's not too bad. And then I open them and it's all from the maintainer. This is awesome. He's taking care of everybody's stuff. And the same with the pull requests. Lots of little automated things from Dependabot or whatever, or just little pull requests and things that other people might have added or whatever, but it's well maintained. I just hope he continues to have the time and energy to keep this going, because the quality of it is top notch for sure.
I'm excited. It's just really beautiful software. I mean, we've kind of been talking about that this whole time. A great maintainer, like an artisan just making cool stuff. I'm sure it started off as I need this, and now it's so right. much great, useful stuff that companies are relying on now. So
that was what we ended up using in the install Rails guide, the official guide. And I'm really happy with it. It works just as well on Mac and Windows and, well, not Windows, Linux. I'm thinking of Windows technically.
I use it on Linux on my
WSL.
I use Mize on my Raspberry Pi. That was the first thing I did, was like, I need to install Mize so that I can do whatever else I need to do.
Yeah.
Which is easy.
Yeah, it's great. I'm looking forward to the migration. What was cool is, so we used RBM Vars, was just a bash script somehow integrated into Ruby or RBM through the execution process. So my like fork of ASDF basically just calls that script before it executes the Ruby or Python or whatever shim that it ended up with. And I'm not going to even have to do any fork of this. I don't really want to fork that because it's a Rust thing. So that's not as easy to like add a line of code into, where a bash script is real simple. But I think we're going to have such an easy time with this, where we can probably just call the script I've already got. We just need to put it on the server and then configure Mize to go call that, and we should be good to go. And it does the same stuff too, but even more of the cool part of RBM Vars was that it checks the current directory, the parent directory, the parent's parent directory, all the way back up to the very top of your file system. So you can then do several things. We have multiple things that are kind of global, maybe our something or other API keys, or we just put a host name or something in an environment variable shared across all the apps, but then all the apps can override and add other environment variables in there in their own directories as they need. Bruh, did you see this?
I have a question.
IBM acquired HashiCorp for $6.4
billion. Damn, no, did not see that.
What?
That's wild. Hold on, before we leave this topic, you can specify path variables in your Mize TOML config. So to add them to the path. So in theory, you could add your bin folder, your Rails bin folder to the path. So then you could just run Rails. So it would automatically source. That should be the way that works, right? It adds every executable to the, if you source the directory, everything executable is added to the path. So.
Wow, that's interesting. Huh.
That's how you could do your multiple version thing. Like if you can change the path.
I saw, what was it, in Omakube maybe? The bash or ZSH or whatever configuration, the path has ./bin in the path. So it's always relative. So whatever folder you're currently in, like your Rails application, you can type Rails, but it's not going to use the gem Rails, it's executable. It's going to use the bin Rails that's relative that will boot up the correct thing with Bundler and get the right one.
Which
and
most like
the Rails executable inside.
Yeah. Most people
you'd have to bundle exec Rails.
Otherwise. Most people use a a lot of people I've found who don't even realize it, but they're using an OhmyZSH plugin that automatically takes a list of gems and adds them to the path. Because all of a sudden people are like, my Rails isn't working. And I'm like, well, that's because you're not using bin Rails. And they're like, but I never run bin Rails. I always do this. And it's because behind the scenes, ZSH was injecting like the bundle exec.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm pretty sure I have that on as well. And I forget about that all the time until I'm like on a server and it's just a different environment because I don't have OhmyZSH on my servers. But yeah, that's fascinating. Dude, there's so much cool stuff.
HashiCorp.
There's that secrets things. Yeah.
HashiCorp.
That's wild.
HashiCorp has Terraform, right? That's theirs.
Yeah. Okay. Along with, oh, I forget all the stuff that they did.
Yeah, yeah. That's the first thing that comes to mind.
Vault, yada, yada. Yeah, because Mitchell stepped down or something from a HashiCorp a while ago. Has been working on Ghosty, the terminal. Which is sweet.
Yeah.
But Ghosty, at least on my Mac, when I SSH into Linux, the keyboard, the input stuff is different. And you have to like register it or something with the server. I forget. There's a doc in there about it. Yeah, no. I go into a bunch of servers and it's too annoying to do that when like iTerm just works fine with SSH. I don't know exactly the technical reason that it's not done automatically or whatever. I assume it'll be fixed at some point, but going from Mac to Linux was like, yeah, the escape key and backspace or whatever just doesn't work. And I was like, what?
That would kill.
Yeah, that was strange. But I know that there's a fix or something for it, but yeah, still confusing.
I use Warp. If I'm using like NeoVim, sometimes I won't use Warp. I'll use like Alacrity. Yeah.
I've got that installed, but I didn't use it too much.
Warp or Alacrity?
Alacrity.
Okay.
Warp looks awesome, though. I just saw...
Warp is amazing.
Do you know that Dave Plummer guy that used to work at Microsoft? He's got a sweet YouTube channel where he like just talks about tech. He owns several PDP-11s, the entire rack and nice. Stuff, and restores them and whatever, and... I didn't watch the video yesterday, but I guess Warp shipped a Windows native
version.
Which is sick. So that's pretty dope. I'm going to have to check it out again. I haven't used it in a while, but I found the little doc on if you use SSH to connect to other machines that do not have Ghosty's term info entry, you'll see error messages. So I guess this term info stuff maybe is a configuration thing that the Ubuntu or whatever would need to add to one of its packages in a future release. And I guess that means that controls some of the configuration or something there. I'm not real sure. It's just a rabbit hole. You can go down a rabbit hole.
I was gonna say we
should Debian packages if you want, but
we need to have
SSH configs.
We need to have a terminal and tools episode again.
Yeah.
Warp is just getting better and better. We definitely talk about that for a while.
Why do I have to register for a terminal?
See, that's what everybody says, and they have a reason, but I don't care. You can turn off telemetry.
Yeah.
It's because you have an account. I have workflows, and they're saved to my account.
Okay.
And you can share like code blocks and stuff like that. So
that's reasonable.
And they have a team feature, too. They've been doing a bunch of work on Warp Drive and the notebooks and the tasks. Yeah, the workflows. So your team can have workflows in Warp like you all have access to that are shared in notebooks and stuff like that. So
that's kind of cool because there's a lot of stuff that if we need to debug something in production or whatever, like it'd be nice to have some shared stuff that I could just have a coworker use that. And it wouldn't necessarily need to live in a script or something in the Rails app or whatever.
Put them in notebooks, like a markdown notebook. You can embed these interactive commands too. Like these workflows, you can give them variables. They're pretty slick. So you could have like an onboarding notebook and literally just list the commands you need to run in order. If you open that, you can just hit the run command on the command block and it runs. That's part of why I think they have that. I've seen people mention that all the time and I'm like, bro, I don't care.
Yeah.
They have a bunch of AI stuff too. I think you can upgrade for like more AI stuff.
You can always upgrade for more AI.
I was going to say their agent stuff that they have built in is really good. And I used it the other day to like find a Git commit, a file that I had lost. All right. It was somewhere and I couldn't find it. And I used warp. Apparently my auto prune wasn't working. So I had like 160 plus branches locally. And I used warp agent mode. I was like, dude, I need you to clean up all of these branches, get rid of all the ones that have been merged. And it went through and like, all right, well, these are tagged as gone from it. So like, and then dropped me down to like 7 branches. And I was like, this is exactly what I wanted. These are the branches that either A, have not been merged and I'm just have locally or are still in progress. This is perfect. This is exactly what I wanted. And then I was able to use it to find the file. So
yeah, literally just was struggling with that because it was, now I'm already forgetting what project it was, but I had updated CodeMirror and Jumpstart on Rails Bytes to the latest. And that was moving from ES Build for CodeMirror to import maps. Some other project I was working on, I need to go copy that, but I can't remember what project I was just doing. And then if I'm going to go grep that entire code folder on my computer,
yeah.
I may never get through that. Searching through so many node modules for different projects, going to take forever. And that would have been helpful just to be like, yeah, literally was just doing this a week ago. What project was that in?
Yeah. And it can like start searching for you. It's pretty nice.
That's cool.
I put a link in the show notes. It's for my referral code. And I just want y'all to know that if you use my referral code, then I'm getting close to baseball hat. So it's a good time to be alive.
You get prizes for referring people.
I referred people before they added a bunch more. So like it used to be just a t-shirt and something else, but now they've got hoodies and notebooks and custom keycaps.
That's cool. I like that a lot.
And dude,
I like that a lot as a way to do a referral program. We're not just going to give you like credit to the service or whatever. Like you refer people to us, we'll give you swag. That's neat. Dude, I like that a lot.
I love the warp shirt because number one, it's a comfortable shirt, but number two, it has this cool like 3D effect on like the warp letter. It's just cool. It's a cool t-shirt. Someone the other day told me, I think it was designed to like look good on Zoom calls, on video calls, because my buddy was like, dude, that shirt is tripping me out. It's almost making me dizzy. And I'm like, dude, I love that shirt. So
that's funny.
Help me get a hoodie, y'all.
So this is the one thing that I have to be concerned about with Warp is similar to what happened with Postman. What went from just a simple app to go test your freaking HTTP requests. What has that become? It's so awful these days. It's so complicated. It's just so annoying. Where it used to be a simple tool, which was great because I don't remember if I got to use dash capital X or whatever to change the method type in curl. I know I can curl dash H, but then I got to sift through all that documentation. Then I got to build up my command, jumping back and forth between the docs and the command I'm writing and scrolling up and down. And it used to be nice and simple. And now what the hell happened to it?
Yeah. And what's nice about Warp, I will create really complicated commands like that. And then I'll literally just right click on the command, hit save as workflow. And you can have it automatically extract things that should be variables, like the URL, for instance, in a curl command, so that I can always rerun it. Nice. And it'll just ask me what URL I want to pass.
Nice.
Yeah. So.
Oh, dude, I got to get back to recording. I'm mostly done with recording for the Rails side of our Learn Hotwire course. If anybody wants to get notified when that's live, that'll be soon. But learnhotwire.com. But I'm like 54 videos into the Turbo Drive, Turbo Streams, Turbo Frames, and Stimulus stuff. I've been asking people, like, what's your pain points with Hotwire? And it's like the documentation. Well, what does that mean? You're confused about how do I properly use a turbo frame and what are the limitations of a turbo frame and whatever else. That's the real questions. Complaining about the docs are bad. What about them are bad? What are the specific troubles that you have so we can improve that stuff? And in the course, actually, it wasn't really planned. I'm building kind of a to-do list, projects with to-dos. and we have views of the projects and you can sort them and whatever, go building those different pages with different examples. My to-dos has infinite scroll pagination, but we like end up implementing that so it works. That breaks another thing, which is, oh, we need to address it this way. And then it was interesting because like I didn't really set out to show those examples where they break other things, but it was such a good thing to have in the course. Actually, this is the stuff you need to know. If you want to use morphs and refreshes, they have these limitations. If you want to use a turbo frame, it has these limitations. There's no way for the server to decide that you are no longer in the turbo frame, at least at the moment. You can work around it and build your own custom stream action or whatever, but the expectation is if you're using a frame, it's either one thing or the other, and at least where the project is at right now. And it's turned out really fun. I've been like pretty stoked on that.
Here's what I need. I need a style guide / cookbook.
Yes.
This is what you use frames for. This is when you don't use frames.
Yes.
This is what you use things for. This is what you don't use them for.
I think I'm going to, I don't know if it'll be a cheat sheet or something we end up including in the course, but I really want to do that. But the other thing that when I was tweeting about this stuff that I wanted to bring up was several people were like, frankly, I want to have the course to train my team. But a bunch of people were also like, I would just love to pay for like Cursor rules files or whatever that gave the advice to Cursor that all the advice you taught in the course, I don't have to keep in my head. I can actually just have it pre-filled out for my editor and AI tool to do that. And I was like, ooh, that's interesting. So
I'm working on that like at Podia right now. I'm trying to compile a list of, it doesn't have to be Cursor like specific, because if you just have the list of instructions, those can be added to Copilot or whatever. Yeah,
and there's similar MCP server stuff that you can do to be even more generic or whatever. But yeah, I thought that was neat. And I think that is an interesting evolution of like, what is a course these days? Maybe not anything you have to watch and memorize and integrate into your flow. It just ends up being a tool you can buy that takes somebody's advice, codifies it, and then it can train your responses in the AI or something like that.
Me personally, and maybe we should hang up before I say this, but me personally, I'm charging, that's an extra tier. If you want that, I'll give you that. Yeah, but I'm going to charge you an extra tier. And yeah, people will pay for that, because me, if I want that, I will just transcribe all your videos and then extract it. But so that's something like I would totally be willing to pay.
That's the idea somebody suggested. Take all the captions and then feed them in. That's interesting. There's a whole lot of stuff you wouldn't want to have in there, which is like when we go down the wrong direction to teach you how to look at this from the right angle, you don't want that in there. But there is a fascinating thing there. And I agree, like, that does make sense for the higher tier version of the course or something. The trouble is like, okay, you could do the Cursor rules file, but what if Cursor isn't the thing in a year?
That's why it just needs to be generic instructions.
And that could just be like freaking Markdown that you could
paste that into a ChatGPT project as a code instructions. I would paste that into a Markdown file and tell Copilot to use that, or Cursor or WinServe or whatever. Like that makes, you just need the instructions. You don't need to make it necessarily tool specific.
Right.
And if you wanted to, you could
you could
just write a quick script to like output the text in the format you need it to based on the tool.
Yeah. So that's pretty cool. I thought that was a nice, super bleeding edge idea to put in a course as an option or something. And even frankly, just, okay, let's do that for Jumpstart too. You want to add a resource and you're not sure how to do it, we can recommend that you always associate whatever resource with not a user, but with an account, because you can swap that and assign it to somebody new, transfer it to a different account, and all you got to do is change the ID. You don't have to have polymorphic things. When it's an account, it can be shared with all the other users, but if you do it to a specific user and then change your mind later on, you're in for a world of pain to go migrate that around. And some of that advice just needs to be like quick and dirty. And then if you want to learn more about why, that could be in the docs as opposed to the little suggestion rules type file or whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever you call it. Some cool stuff though.
I do that. We have basically the account version Podia. Like we always now add it to every record. And so I just have in my Copilot instructions, whenever we're generating a migration for a new table, always add a reference to account. So
yeah,
there's a lot of interesting stuff there, but
yeah,
I think we're ready to
hit
the hay, hit the road. I got to work too. So
dude.
Dude.
All right. Catch you in a week.
Hell yeah.